Well, by way of reminder, so David is no longer in exile. He lived that way for 10 some odd years, but he's returned home now to Israel, where upon his arrival, he was declared king in the southern capital of Hebron by the people of Judah. Saul has been killed, Israel's first king, with his sons in battle with the Philistines, but Abner, who was Saul's commander of his armies, he set up one of Saul's sons in his place, Ish-bosheth. He is now king in the north, and Israel is divided. They're now a nation that's split. But David has chosen patience, because remember, David, he's called to be king over the entire country, over all 12 of the tribes, yet it's not happening right now. David, though, he's chosen, he's determined to trust the Lord and his timing again. David, we've been surprised. I have, I don't know about you, impacted by how he's been faced with just these immense struggles and obstacles between he and God's calling on his life. And though he's not a perfect man, and there's lots of places where we see him mess up, this is one of the areas where he does really well, where he trusts God and he says, Lord, your timing. God, my eyes are on you. And when it's your plan and purpose, then you'll make the way open for me to sit on the throne. And at that time, he would rule when God determined it to be so. But following what we looked at last week, a fight between a small group of Abner's soldiers and Joab's. Joab is the commander of David's army. This took place at the Pool of Gibeon, which we looked at again last week. A prolonged fighting ensued. That little fight ended up spreading to where now it's going to be years of these battles that are taking place between the north and the south. This morning, our message is titled Intrigue, Revenge, and Grief in the Kingdom, because that's sort of the movements that we make our way through as we enter into this chapter, 1 Samuel chapter 3, verses 1 through 39. Verse 1, we'll read verses 1 through 4 as we get started. Now, there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. And what this really means isn't that there was, you know, one front in which these two armies confronted each other for years on end, but instead that there were many individual battles that took place for several years. But David, we read, grew stronger and stronger, and the house of Saul grew weaker and weaker. So as time passed, this conflict between David and Saul's armies, it only increased. But David was the one who was growing stronger. Verse 2, sons were born to David in Hebron. His firstborn was Amnon by Ahinoam the Jezreelitess. His second, Chileab by Abigail, the widow of Nabal the Carmelite. The third, Absalom, the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, the king of Geshur. The fourth, Adonijah, the son of Haggith. The fifth, Shephatiah, the son of Abital. And the sixth, Ithream, by David's wife, Eglah. These were born to David in Hebron. So during this season of war between the north and the south, David, while in Hebron, through various wives, was having many sons. Six were born, and many more were coming, we'll find later. Sadly, this represents in David a contradiction. Though he grew stronger militarily, although his kingdom was being established, he was simultaneously introducing weakness. David knew better. He understood the law, the Torah, in which God had made for Adam one wife, declaring in Genesis chapter 2, verse 24, therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. Deuteronomy reinforces this model of marriage being designed by God and intended for one man and one woman, specifically noting that Israel's kings were to have only one wife. Deuteronomy 17:17. Neither shall he multiply wives for himself, speaking of Israel's king, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he greatly multiply silver and gold for himself. God told the children of Israel, the kings were not to amass wealth or many horses. They weren't to go down to Egypt. And they were to make for themselves one handwritten copy of the law, which they were to study all the days of their lives. And they were to have only one wife. Now, not only would David, would his many wives become a problem for he and his family, and for that matter, the nation, but so too would his many children. We just read of six that have been born to him since he was ruling in the south, but he'll have a total of 20 sons and one daughter that we know of. We're not going to skip ahead right now, but of these sons that are listed, several in particular are going to cause David and Israel great pain. Those of you that are familiar with 1 and 2 Samuel or Kings or Chronicles, you know some of these names and who they are. His legacy of polygamy, it's going to create lasting damage. Had David purposed to follow God's clear instruction, he would have saved himself, his family, and the nation a great deal of anguish and trouble. And it's a good place to pause as we get started in chapter 3 this morning, and to remember that stepping outside of God's design is a guarantee of pain and problems. Determining that we know better, that God will overlook our sin, is foolish. Deliberately disobeying God will not only result in discipline, but the natural consequences of our rebellion. Not sometimes, but always. It's healthy to be reminded of this real principle found in Galatians chapter 6, verse 7. Paul wrote to that church, "Do not be deceived. Don't be tricked. Don't be fooled. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, that he will also reap. For he who sows to his flesh will of the flesh reap corruption, but he who sows to the Spirit will of the Spirit reap everlasting life." We need to be warned, we need to be cautioned in our lives that when Scripture says no, when God has set up a fence and said, don't trespass, don't cross to the other side, there's a reason for it. David probably had all kinds of reasons and arguments why it was okay for him to have six wives and others that were coming. Looking around at surrounding cultures, at other kings, at all the work that he had done. You know, you deserve a break today. Why not another wife? You know, all these justifications, like what we come up with for you probably, you know, well, I don't know what's going on in your lives, but I'm assuming no one has six spouses. But anyhow, we do this for our own indulgences of the flesh. But the reality is there's a price tag attached to disobedience. And we're not going to see that immediately unfold before us today, but it's coming in chapters ahead. Now, for right now, we're going to leave that issue behind regarding David's personal life as we look at what's happening on the national stage in this divided country. Verses 6 through 21, trouble in the north, Abner defects. Now it was so, while there was war between the house of Saul and the house of David during this time of all this fighting, that Abner was strengthening his hold on the house of Saul. Abner, that commander in the north, he's sort of conniving and contriving to kind of wrap his tentacles around the throne upon which Ishbosheth was sitting, as we'll see again today. This weak son of Saul's, just sort of a puppet. And Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. So Ishbosheth said to Abner, "Why have you gone into my father's concubine?" Then Abner became very angry at the words of Ishbosheth and said, "Am I a dog's head that belongs to Judah? Today I show loyalty to the house of Saul, your father, to his brothers and to his friends, and have not you delivered... and have not, excuse me, delivered you into the hand of David. And you charge me today with a fault concerning this woman?" Abner's saying, all that I've done for you, Ishbosheth, how dare you accuse me of this after everything that I've done? May God do so to Abner, to me, and more also, if I do not do for David as the Lord has sworn to him. Abner says, I am done with you, Ishbosheth, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and set up the throne of David over Israel and over Judah from Dan to Beersheba, kind of from the north to the south. And he could not answer Abner another word because he feared him. It's hard to know exactly what's going on here because we're not told one way or another as to whether or not Ishbosheth's accusation of Abner taking one of Ishbosheth's father's, Saul's concubines, is true or not. But Abner's definitely offended by the king. Was he innocent? Or did he get caught with his hand in the proverbial cookie jar? Is he now protesting too much? Like, he got caught, and so now he's fighting back, but really it's from a place of guilt, swinging the pendulum to the extreme in self-defense by defecting to David. What Ishbosheth, to back up here for a moment and explain this, is accusing Abner of is going into or sleeping with one of his father's concubines. And that was a wife that was really more just a sexual partner. This woman named Rizpah. Understand that doing so, having intercourse with any of the kings, be he dead or alive, any of his wives or concubines, it was tantamount to claiming the kingdom. It was what some did or could do after ascending to the throne. Sort of an act of dominance, consolidating power. It was a symbolic act, and obviously more than symbolic. But anyway, it was something that happened and was done in that day. I'm not saying it was right, and they didn't all do it, but it is going to come up again. We'll see later in 2 Samuel. Now, Abner, though, rather than give a straight answer, rather than defend himself and say, I didn't do that, or I did, what are you going to do about it? He instead becomes extremely defensive, as we read and noted, which leads me personally to tend to assume guilt on his part, just my opinion. But for whatever reason, he wasn't ready at this time to follow through his full intentions. Was he with Rizpah, and was it to make a statement, and then did he change his mind? We're really not sure. We don't know. But what we do know is that Abner, he is angry, he's offended, and he's leaving. He's leaving the north. Maybe for some reason, getting called out makes him skittish about trying to take the throne from Ishbosheth, if that was his plan. It's a little strange. After all, we read clearly in verse 6 that Abner was strengthening his hold on the house of Saul. That was his intent. We mentioned last week that Abner, he seemed to be using Ishbosheth, setting him up as a puppet, controlling the northern kingdom through his weak leadership. And we know he's weak. Verse 11 says, after Ishbosheth confronted him, he really didn't do anything else. He couldn't. But it's also possible, again, that he was trying, that Abner was trying to seek to control, to take over the kingdom. Excuse me, let me back up a moment. It's also possible that that was not his intention yet anyway, that he wasn't yet trying to stage a full coup to push Ishbosheth out, but that he was starting to act like the king. In other words, maybe Abner was getting a little too comfortable, kind of putting his feet up on the coffee table, as it were. And I'm sorry, I know that's a bad comparison to sleeping with Rizpah, but the idea is Ishbosheth looks at him and goes, what are you doing? And Abner kind of blushes and goes, oh, whoops, I've shown my cards a little too much. In my mind, I'm imagining myself to be king when I'm not, or I'm not yet. And then he panicked when he got caught. So somewhere in there is what happened. Whatever the case, Abner reacts to Ishbosheth's rebuke in an extreme way, abandoning his efforts to establish Saul, his son as king. That's all over now. But not surprisingly, Ishbosheth's response in verse 11 is weak. Regardless, this is the new direction that Abner is taking. Verse 12, then Abner sent messengers on his behalf to David, saying, whose is the land? Saying also, imagine you're David, and this messenger comes bringing this word. This would be a surprise. It's been years of fighting by the instigation of this man sending the message. Make your covenant with me, and indeed my hand shall be with you to bring all Israel to you. And David said, good, I will make a covenant with you, but one thing I require of you, you shall not see my face unless you bring first Michal, Saul's daughter, when you come to see my face. So David sent messengers to Ishbosheth, Saul's son, saying, give me my wife, whom I betrothed to myself for 100 foreskins of the Philistines. And Ishbosheth sent and took her from her husband, from Paltiel, the son of Laish. Then her husband went along with her to Bahurim, weeping behind her. So Abner said to him, go return. And he returned. That's really sad. Here, Abner and David, they're communicating between messengers. Abner says, David, I'm with you. And I want to help reunite the kingdom. I'm done with fighting against you and hanging out with Ishbosheth in the north. And David says, awesome, let's do this. But I've got one thing I want, my wife, that is Saul's daughter, who was promised to me and then was taken away after we'd been married and I had to flee. And Abner says, fine, you can have her. I don't see a problem with that. Sends his man over, pulls her out of her home from the guy she was married to, and sends her down south with her husband following after, mourning and crying. And then it's kind of sad. Abner looks at the guy and says, would you go home? Get over it. You know, it's like, man, Abner, have a heart here. But he doesn't. Verse 12, make your covenant with me, and indeed my hand shall be with you to bring all Israel to you. David is interested, but again, his one stipulation is that he gets Michal, his wife, back. Who would be wife number seven? And you know, you kind of, your heart goes out to David. He's only got six wives, and he's been deprived of this one, and so, you know, we understand. No, I'm just kidding. It's just an extension of what we already talked about. But we also already talked about this whole issue of a king and his wife or wives. He wants this issue locked up as far as those women who are rightfully his. He's not about to be king while another man has this woman who was once his own bride. Was this necessary? No. Could he have left well enough alone with Michal and her husband? Definitely. But this is not an area in David's life where he did well. David did not manage his home life the way God would have had him to. But tradition aside and David's motivations and sin aside, David, especially so in regards to women, he keeps moving further outside of what God's law had declared to be acceptable, and that was an extension of his sin, actually. He doesn't seem to be bothered by it, which is kind of strange, isn't it? Because we see these extreme ways in other areas where David was willing to sacrifice and trust the Lord. And yet this one that maybe seems really obvious to some of us, we might go, David, what are you thinking? He doesn't seem to get it. With this poor man, Paltiel, following his wife, weeping. It's sad. Now, despite this being a bit messy, Abner moves forward with helping David and uniting the northern tribes around his leadership. David immediately begins to make good on his commitment. Verse 17, now Abner had communicated with the elders of Israel, saying, in time past you were seeking for David to be king over you. Now then, do it. It's as though Abner has kind of been this this dam, this dike holding back the will of the northern tribes in a sense. I mean, he had been party to convincing them that David shouldn't be king, but he was aware. He knew that there was talk. He knew the people knew David was to be king. He knew it himself. And so now he states the obvious, and he encourages and goads the people and says, now's the time. Let's do it. For the Lord has spoken of David, saying, by the hand of my servant David, I will save my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines and the hand of all their enemies. And Abner also spoke in the hearing of Benjamin. That was the house and family of Saul. Then Abner also went to speak in the hearing of David in Hebron. So he did all this work, speaking to everybody, reaching out to them, getting them on page to join David in the south with Judah. And then he went to David himself again. He did so in the hearing of David. He spoke all that seemed good to Israel in the house of Benjamin. So Abner and 20 men with him came to David at Hebron, and David made a feast for Abner and the men who were with him. Then Abner said to David, I will arise and go and gather all Israel to my lord the king, that they may make a covenant with you, and that you may reign over all that your heart desires. So David sent Abner away, and he went in peace. Abner immediately sets about this campaign of turning the northern tribes in loyalty to David. Does what he said he was going to do. And what an encouragement this must have been to David. Finally, after all these years of waiting, of trusting God, frankly, also of doubting, of being in discouragement. Hope deferred makes the heart sick, the Proverbs speak to. But when a vision, a dream, a desire is realized, what an encouragement and what a joy it brings. And that must have been happening in David's heart right now as he'd spent all this time waiting and watching, resting and trusting God's purpose and timing, to now see an enemy turn in his heart towards not only David, but the Lord. Embracing God's purpose and plan for Israel, it's tremendous. But isn't that often when the enemy comes to exploit and to spoil and disrupt the good that the Lord had in mind? And how important it is in those difficult times that God's people respond and react rightly. Well, we'll see how that all turns out. But while David and Abner have been working out this peace treaty and planning for the reunification of Israel under one king, Joab has been out of town. Now remember, Joab is the commander of David's armies down in the south, and he's the brother of the man that Abner killed in battle, whom we studied last week. Remember that little skirmish that unfolded at the pool of Gibeon? And the man, the soldier who ran after Abner, his name was Asahel, and he was brother to Joab. They were all related to David. Well, as Abner was running from Asahel and tried to discourage him and say, would you leave me alone? Stop chasing after me. Well, finally, he just turned around and he jabbed his spear into Asahel, who immediately fell dead. Joab has not forgotten that, and Joab is still carrying bitterness against Abner. Unforgiveness and an appetite for vengeance. Joab wants to correct this wrong. Our next point this morning is root of bitterness. Joab conspires, verses 22 through 30. And that moment, the servants of David and Joab came from a raid and brought much spoil with them. So all this has taken place where messengers have gone back and forth, and Abner's doing all this work to communicate with everybody, and Michal is brought back to Hebron, and David's happy, and things are moving toward reunification. And now Joab rolls up with his soldiers. They're sweaty, but they're happy. They've been raiding against some other people group, and they brought in a bunch of spoils of war, and David's going to be happy, and they're feeling pretty good. Abner was not with David in Hebron, for he had sent him away, and he had gone in peace. Joab rolls up, and Abner's gone, because he's already met with David, had the feast, and gone back up to the north. When Joab and all the troops that were with him had come, they told Joab, They said to him, have you heard what happened while you were gone? Abner, the son of Ner, came to the king. Yeah, that Abner, Joab. And he sent him away, and he has gone in peace. Then Joab came to the king. He just busts into the palace where David had the kingdom set up. And he says, what have you done? Look, Abner came to you. Why is it that you sent him away? And he has already gone. Surely you realize that Abner, the son of Ner, came to deceive you, to know you're going out and you're coming in, and to know all that you are doing. And when Joab had gone from David's presence, he sent messengers after Abner, who brought him back from the well of Sirah, but David did not know it. We'll stop there. So while all this peace treaty, negotiating, and diplomacy work has been going on between Abner and David, Joab was out of town on kingdom business, again, attacking some enemy and securing spoil for the palace. And upon his return, he learns that Abner has just left. And all that was agreed upon between he and David, and Joab is not happy. Can I just note that what is unfolding is absolutely the will of God? But because Joab is walking in the flesh, because Joab is harboring bitterness and unforgiveness, he cannot see it, and in spite of himself or because of himself, he is in opposition to it. He is hindering it. If you want to be a person who's living in the will of God, who's doing the will of God, you can't be room for bitterness and unforgiveness and a heart that has a taste for vengeance in your life. It will exclude you from the kingdom of God and his purposes. And it will cause you to be a hindrance to the people and to the work of God. And it was so for Joab. Joab, he goes straight to David. Seems like Joab and David both, excuse me, it seems like Joab and Abner both have some similar problems. They both have these attitudes where it's like, man, show a little respect to the king here, a little humility. A little too much familiarity. He lets him know just how frustrated he is, how much he disagrees with the king's plans. He tells him, surely you know that Abner, the son of man, came to deceive you. Think about it. Who's the one that's really deceiving David here? To know you're going out and you're coming in and to know all that you are doing. He rebukes him. Joab, he sounds like he's upset on David's behalf. How could you do this, David? Abner can't be trusted. He's done this just so he can find out what we're really up to, that he might ready an attack against us. And you've just opened the door to that. He convinces David, tries to, that this was a strategic blunder, that David can't be trusted. But we're going to learn shortly, this is about something else entirely, of course. Joab is still bitter over the murder of his brother Asahel. He's just mad he missed the opportunity against him. And he's mad now because he knows David. He's seen David pass up the opportunity to take out his enemies. And he's looking at this going, I am going to have to spend the rest of my life serving alongside of Abner. Now, David, he's not just sparing his enemies. He's cooperating with them. He's bringing them into our very home, the palace. Joab does not have the same heart as his king. He'd missed his opportunity to exact vengeance, but he's going to manipulate circumstances to regain the upper hand. And there is a warning in this chapter in Joab's hatred for Abner. Nursing a grudge, holding on to bitterness, it's dangerous. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 14. Pursue peace with all people and holiness, without which no one will see the Lord. Looking carefully, lest anyone fall short of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up cause trouble. And by this, many become defiled. I think it's important for us to recognize the language that the author of Hebrews uses here. It's a root of bitterness. It's not some oak tree where it's like right in the middle of everything and it's obvious and you can't help but see it. It's just a little root. When I was a kid, my parents would make my sisters and I pull weeds. We were abused, in case you're wondering. And we grew up out in the Inland Empire. We're doing it under the heat of the sun, and the enemy is active. And be glad you didn't sit in the overflow, because there's like large insects attacking everyone right now. Okay, you're the Lord's blessing is on you. Someone's in sin out here, but I'm just kidding. It's you know those green, we called them Chinese beetles when I was a kid. I don't know their real name. They have horrible vision, so they fly like they're trying to attack you, but really they can't see you anyway. I don't know what we're doing. No, I'm just kidding. When I was a kid, my parents would make us pull weeds, and they were very particular. They would not go for just ripping off the top, because a lot of those weeds, man, they'll grow right back, and now they've got this big knot right at the base of the dirt, and they're even harder to pull out the second time. No, they'd water the ground ahead of time. That's a sprinkler, in case you didn't know what that was. Sorry. Pull it up. We want to see the roots. We got to pay attention for a root of bitterness, a seemingly innocuous influence that has and runs the risk of becoming a stronghold, something that will do far greater damage in our lives in the long term. Looking carefully, lest anyone fall short of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up cause trouble, and by this many become defiled. When you and I hold on to a grudge, when we allow bitterness to take root in our hearts, we're falling short of the grace of God in our lives. We're failing to allow its full work in ourselves, grace. And therefore, we're unable to extend it to others. Have you ever recognized that when you have a hard time giving yourself grace, that's kind of how you treat others too. You're kind of a spiritual miser, because you're not really allowing God to do everything he wants to do in you. And I know it might seem counterintuitive that somehow releasing vengeance and bitterness and all of that is for you, but it is, isn't it? Because when we hold on to it, it's as someone once said, it's like drinking poison and waiting for the other person to die. It harms us, but it doesn't harm us only. It has a defiling effect in our lives, Hebrews says. It spoils God's work in and through us. That unchecked jealousy, hatred, and bitterness, it's defiling you. But also the body of Christ. It hurts the church when we allow those things to continue in us. Now, verse 26, and when Joab had gone from David's presence, he sent messengers from Abner, who brought him back from the well of Sirah, but David did not know it. And so apart from the king's knowledge, he calls Abner back, probably under the guise of some official business. We wouldn't be surprised if he actually used David's name. Perhaps even claiming the king himself needed Abner again for something. But Abner, believing himself to be safe and a new era of trust and friendship having been entered in his relationship with the king in the south, he returned to Hebron without suspecting any danger or trouble. Verse 27, when Abner had returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside in the gate to speak with him privately. We imagine we can see it. And there he stabbed him in the stomach so that he died for the blood of Asahel, his brother. When David heard it, he said, my kingdom and I are guiltless before the Lord forever of the blood of Abner, the son of Ner. Let it rest on the head of Abner and on all his father's house, and let there never fail to be in the house of Joab one who has a discharge or is a leper, who leans on a staff or falls by the sword or who lacks bread. That's quite a curse that David has unloaded on Joab and his house. The Joab's family would forever bear the guilt for Abner's murder. and that they would always have among them a leper or someone with a disease of some kind. That they would have the maimed and the crippled among them, and that they'd always be poor, someone would in their family. So Joab, verse 30, and Abishai, his brother, killed Abner because he had killed their brother Asahel at Gibeon in the battle. This is messy. While Abner had fought Asahel in battle in broad daylight, if you just got lost there because we're almost at the end, that's the guy that Abner killed, the brother of Joab. He did it in broad daylight on the battlefield. Joab pulls Abner into a dark alley, luring him back to the city under false pretenses. Hebron was actually a city of refuge. And once again, that was a place, according to the law, where someone accused of or guilty of involuntary manslaughter, accidental murder, it was where they could flee, and they were under the protection of the city. The family of the deceased could not harm them while within the city gates. And it would seem, according to the language, that what Joab did here was he sees Abner coming, and it says he in the gate. And it may very well be that he kind of pulled him aside as he was walking in, but not quite as he passed through the gate. And there he murdered him in cold blood. It was wrong. And David, while not punishing Abner outright, does recognize this by grieving, by cursing Abner and his family, and going so far as to lead the nation in mourning. Cursing Joab and his family, excuse me. The king was innocent, but it's a serious problem that had the potential to bring grave consequences. Think about it. Abner was the ambassador from the north, helping to coordinate a reunification and peace treaty between these two groups, between the tribes of the north and those of the south. And now he's been murdered by the commander of the south. You think that has the potential to cause problems? Yeah, it has the potential to cause everything to unravel. He's caught in a very difficult position. He recognizes Joab's anger and hurt over his brother's death, yet he's got a kingdom to manage and unite. And Joab taking things into his own hands like this, it wasn't the right course of action. David had resisted that very thing again and again, and this had to truly grieve him. So he publicly distances himself from this rash action. He lays all of the guilt and blame at Joab's feet, calling on him a curse and calling the nation to mourn. It would have been easy for David to lean into this poetic justice a bit. Remember, Abner had caused David a lot of trouble. It would have been easy for David to kind of little grin on his face, or at least in his heart, and go, well, what can you do? Technically, he wasn't in the city of refuge, and after all, Abner did murder Joab's brother, and it was kind of an uncalled for, dark thing. Joab's done a lot of wicked things in his life, but he doesn't do that. His perspective is broader. He chooses to see the good that Abner was doing, the change. Think about how we reflected on that when David had opportunities to lift up his hand against Abner. And how we reflected on the reality that God was walking him through that painful place in the wilderness when no one was watching and he was accountable only to God, understanding that God called David to be king. There would be moments, not in the middle of the wilderness, but in front of everyone, where David would have to choose the right thing, where David would have to trust God with his enemies. The Lord had trusted David and prepared him there, and now, when he had the opportunity to do the wrong thing, he was prepared in the fear of God to do the right thing. Reminds me of a proverb we shared recently on a Sunday, chapter 24, verse 17, "Do not rejoice when your enemy falls, and do not let your heart be glad when he stumbles, lest the Lord see it and it displease him, and he turn away his wrath from him." And the implication is that he turn his discipline toward you and I. Now, thankfully for David, he not only had the wisdom, but I think also the personal conviction to quickly and publicly rebuke Joab, followed by, again, the mourning and the cursing. And this is going to prove to be effective in convincing the north that this was the action of one zealous man and his brother Abishai, as we read, who in various ways is going to bear the guilt and punishment for his actions. The king makes clear to Israel that he personally had loved and been a friend to their commander, who was the architect of this new unified Israel. Not to mention, this just wasn't in Israel, in David's heart. He didn't want this. He was a man who trusted God with those who hated and opposed him. Now, lastly, we'll look more closely at David's public grief over Joab's vengeful murder of Abner. A kingdom perspective, David mourns, our final point for the morning. Then David said to Joab and to all the people who were with him, "Tear your clothes, gird yourselves with sackcloth, and mourn for Abner." And King David followed the coffin. David just doesn't himself grieve, but he leads the people in doing so, calling them to rend their garments and weep with him, walking himself with Abner's coffin. So they buried Abner in Hebron, and the king lifted up his voice and wept at the grave of Abner. And all the people wept, and the king sang a lament over Abner and said, "Should Abner die as a fool dies? Your hands were not bound, nor your feet put into fetters. As a man falls before wicked men, so you fell. Abner, he was murdered through deception, in cold blood." And David, in this funeral dirge, this song of lament, he sings about that. He didn't die as a warrior or a prisoner. Abner was a victim. Then all the people wept over him again. And when all the people came to persuade David to eat food while it was still day, David took an oath saying, "God, do so to me and more also if I taste bread or anything else until the sun goes down." And so David reinforces his grief through fasting that day. Now all the people took note of it, and it pleased them, since whatever the king did pleased all the people. For all the people in all Israel understood that day that it had not been the king's intent to kill Abner the son of Ner. Then the king said to his servants, "Do you not know that a prince and a great man has fallen today in Israel? And I am weak today, though anointed king. And these men, the sons of Zeruiah, are too harsh for me. The Lord shall repay the evildoer according to his wickedness." David was weak, but he was weak because of the brokenness that God had wrought in his life in all the years prior. His weakness allowed him to mourn the death of an enemy. His weakness allowed him to set aside his agenda and his kingdom in favor of God's. It allowed David to effectively say, "Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven." God wants that same weakness in your lives and mine. This isn't just a campaign on David's part to keep his kingdom on track. This isn't just political posturing. It's the real thing. David's heart was truly broken over this. The whole mess, it grieved him deeply. And the people knew it. And this was part of the greatness in David's leadership. Though imperfect, he loved God and he loved the people of God. And they knew it. In responding to Abner's death the way that he did, David, in many ways, was saying to the people of God, "You matter more than I do." And that's the heart of a true leader before the Lord. Now all the people took note of it, and it pleased them, since whatever the king did pleased all the people. This morning we're sharing in communion, Pastor Frankie, maybe you and the worship team, Steve and Mike and Tatiana, if you can join us. Whatever the king did pleased all the people. God blessed David's rule in this way. the people recognized that Joab, not David, had carried out this act. David reiterated his respect for Abner as a prince and a great man, and his frustration and exhaustion with Joab and his brother. In today's chapter, there are failures and there are successes. David, he failed personally. Joab failed personally and publicly. David also enjoyed some public successes that were rooted in private strength and success before the Lord. Those who learned to forgive and trust God with their enemies, and those who couldn't, may we be, you and I, those men and women who walk in the liberty and freedom of the grace that we've experienced through the cross, that we would trust God with our life circumstances, our trials, our tribulations, those things that we can't control. Choosing to forgive, choosing to walk in love towards those that haven't done the same to us is a necessary place to start. For David, it was the beginning of his living in God's kingdom purposes for his life. And it's that way for you and I as well.